you what, our poems podcast, the only poetry podcast not seeped in pretension. Grimes. Remember Grimes? That's Claire Elise Boucher. Boucher? Known professionally as Grimes. She's a Canadian musician, singer, songwriter, and a record producer. Her music has incorporated elements of varied styles. Grime, it says here, was born in Vancouver. I don't know, though. I think Grimes is a robot. What are your feelings, folks? What is Grime? What is Grime? What are Grimes?
I am Grimes.
Grimes.
I am Grimes.
No Grimes. Grimes, get out of here. Grimes.
I am Grimes.
No Grimes.
I am Grimes. Feed me salami.
Grimes. I got that. I did that the other week, and I was like, that's how I'll open the show. I'll do a whole thing with Grimes. It'll be interesting for everybody. What if Grimes became a featured... my side. Remember how I always want a sidekick? I've been saying forever, a band and a sidekick for What Are Poems? What if it was Grimes?
I am Grimes.
Very good, Grimes.
I am Grimes. Feed me salami.
Who's to say? Who's to say what's next? We got a good one today. Gotta get right into it, though, because it's a long, I want to tell the whole story for once. I don't want to just graze over this one because it's very interesting. There's a movie about this lady, a documentary. Polly Murray. Very good. Civil rights activist, poet, revolutionary. We're kind of getting into that thing, aren't we? Here on What Are Poems? All right. When we come back, right into it, right into the poetry. What is it? Hello? What are we going to talk about today? We're going to talk about Polly Murray. It's important that we talk about Polly Murray. Polly Murray is this Episcopal priest. She's a lawyer. She's a civil rights activist. She's a gender equality activist. She's a lady that everyone in this country should know about, yet nobody does. And we wonder why, you know, because she's a little different. But her history is thick. It's running alongside our history, you know. She changed history for blacks and women and transgender people later on down the road without even realizing that was a thing. Because she wasn't sure about herself. But she's the real deal. She's a trailblazer. Let's get into it. Do you know her? She's born in Baltimore, Maryland. Carl Shapiro, land as it'll be. And she ends up moving south with her maternal family. After her mother dies of a cerebral hemorrhage and her father starts having some emotional problems from this. And they also think also because of typhoid fever. So he loses custody of both his children and he's later killed in a psychiatric hospital just for black people because that's how the world was. It's just the black psychiatric hospital. The Crownsville State Hospital for the Negro Insane, a white guard bludgeons her father with a white baseball bat, and she was 16 at this time, and she thought, you know what, I'm going to go, I'm going to rescue him, I'm going to get him out of there, but she fails to do so, and then she moves at 16 from Durham to New York, where she moves with some family, and it's in a predominantly white neighborhood, where the family there is kind of passing for white, and Polly Murray's a little darker, and that frightens the neighborhood, because everyone's a racist. At this point, even in old New York City, the Big Apple, the old progressive shining light on the hill, they're still not having it. So she goes to this Richmond Hill High School in 1927, and then she enrolls in Hunter College 2 years later. And around this time in 1930, she marries this dude known as William Roy Lynn, or Billy Wynn to his friends. But the marriage doesn't work because they kind of spend the honeymoon in a cheap West Side hotel. It's a disaster. Polly Murray's uncomfortable having sex with men. She later says she wants to feel normal, but this other part of her resists, and she says, why is it when men try to make love to me, something in me fights? So they separate, and they don't see each other again until the marriage is annulled in 49, so quite a few years later. At Hunter College, though, Polly Murray is doing really well. She's writing great essays. She gets an A for one about her maternal grandfather, and she graduates there in 1933 with a bachelor degree in arts. But as she's coming out of college, what's happening? Same thing that happened to the millennials. The job market scratch. It's the Great Depression. There's not a chicken in every pot. People are living in Hoover dams, Hoover blankets. It's Hoover Town all over the USA. And so she can't find a job. It's very difficult to find a job. She tries to sell subscriptions to magazines, to academic journals, the National Urban League, and but poor health forces her to resign from this. And the doctor says she got to go somewhere a little warmer. Like the doctor been telling me for years, Jake, get out of Pennsylvania, go somewhere warm. That eczema's gonna clear up. But hey, skin's skin, right? So I'm gonna keep having the eczema. Keep living in Pennsylvania because my cat and my girlfriend are here. You know what? Also, I got the little Pepsis. I was in the store, and there was all the different deals that you see at Shields on George Ave. This isn't an ad for Shields on George Ave, but that's just where I go to get my, my cheese and my pot roast needs, soups, cat food. But we all know about the cat food crisis happening in this country too, because there's no beef shreds. And Elliot, my main man, my boy. The old man, he only likes the beef shreds. So it is chaos in this house. We were trying to give old Bones Gertie some pate the other day. She's not having it. She says, "What's this, Daddy? Daddy, why is it shaped like a little cup?" I say, "It's pate, Gert. You got to eat it." I said, "There's no shreds. There's no meaty bits. You got to have..." "Why, Daddy? I never had to eat this before, Daddy." I say, "Here, have a little soup." You ever see those? You got cats? Little soups. It's like a little, it's a little bag, and when you shake it, it just sounds wet, and you could pour that on there, you could open that up, and you can give it to them, and they drink it like soup. Why shouldn't your cats have soup? That's what somebody at Frisky's is asking right now. He's sitting there, he's sweating, he says, "Why not give the cat soup?" They go, "You're crazy, Carl, you've been crazy all these years." "But the cat should be able to eat soup, too. I love soup." Carl, please. Please, Carl. So, it's just pate country out there. You got to realize that. What the hell am I talking about? Oh, yeah, so she can't get a job. Polly Murray, our girl. I'm having a little Pepsi, that's why. I needed to sip something. My voice is a little dry. So, she takes a position at Camp Terra. It's a she conservation camp, which is kind of like the play on the CCC, which were camps for... men looking to help out, to build the country back up. Easy jobs. My grandfather on my mother's side was in the CCC. Said he loved it. Never knew him, but I've heard he loved it. One of those things that he's passed along, you know, in death. I love the CCC. I love taking my shovel and breaking new ground. So when she's at this CCC camp, she makes good friends with this lady named Peg Holmes. Because, I mean, who's not going to be friends with Peg Holmes? But it's a cross-racial relationship. Peg Holmes, a white lady. She's a white counselor. Murray, a black lady. They're just having a great time. But this other lady disapproves of it. She's the head counselor. It's like, "I don't like this at all. Big racist." So then Eleanor Roosevelt comes strutting through the camp, through the she camp, or Old Al. And Pauli Murray's sitting there, and she's going, "Well, the Roosevelts aren't doing anything for me. You know, they're not doing anything for black people. They're not doing anything for women." So she doesn't stand up when Eleanor Roosevelt comes in, and the counselor's furious. She says, you're hanging out with Peg Holmes. You won't stand when Eleanor Roosevelt comes in, and I'm disgusted by this. So Murray says, "Forget it." She says, "Peg, let's go." So they begin traveling the country, walking, hitchhiking, hopping freight trains all over the country, her and Peg Holmes. It's a great time in her life, I'm assuming. But also in this time, she does start a correspondence with Eleanor Roosevelt, and they correspond for most of their lives together, back and forth, you know. And she says, "Hey, Mrs. Roosevelt, there's a reason I didn't stand. It's because, you know, you're not doing anything for black people. You're not doing anything for women, you know, and all this stuff." And Eleanor Roosevelt goes, "Hey, I get it. I get it, Pauli Murray. But, you know, change takes time," which is sort of the great call of the left in this country, isn't it? Which I'm a part of. As I always say, you know, I'd rather be in a tent with a bunch of people that are near communists and people that are Klansmen. So I go left. You got to go left in this country. You go right, it's scary. It's scary over there on the right. I keep getting political, but you know what I'm saying? So after she's done hitchhiking, Murray applies to the PhD program in sociology at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. But she's rejected on the basis of her race. And all the schools and other public facilities in the state were segregated by law, as was the case across the South. And so this case is broadly publicized that she's rejected. And she sends the correspondence between the college and herself to all the newspapers. It makes it a very public thing. She sends a letter to President Roosevelt and all this stuff. And the NAACP is going to step in to try to help her. But then the head of the NAACP, this Roy Wilkins guy, which is kind of proof right here in what Pauli Murray fights for a large part of her life, is that, yes, there's this black civil rights movement happening. And yes, it is so focused on men. And the women aren't getting enough credit for standing with the men and continuing the civil rights movement a lot of time in their absence and being a support system and doing the work. You know what I mean? So Roy Wilkins says that it's not diplomatic how she does it, and he won't help. And he also has concerns about her sexuality, which will also pop up in her life because Maria, she often wears pants because that's a crime back then in the 30s, early 40s. Can't wear pants. When the women got to get together? When they do it? It was had to be in a house somewhere where someone's like, fuck it, Linda, I'm wearing pants tomorrow. All right, Helen, me too. Wearing a skirt every day of your life? Come on. It gets old. You got to wear pants. I love wearing pants. What, you're supposed to wear, you can't even wear pants in the wintertime at one point in this country? You're not supposed to? Look down upon? Some man's going, oh, well, I don't care if your legs are cold. You're wearing a skirt. I'd say, Helen, Linda, put the pants on. Let's do it. So Murray then, in 1940, Murray was walking the streets of Rhode Island distraught after the disappearance of a woman friend who was taken into police custody. And she was transferred to the Bellevue Hospital in New York City for psychiatric treatment. And then in March, Murray left the hospital with McBean, who was her roommate and her girlfriend. And then she's taken back to Durham on a bus to her aunt's. So at this whole time, she tours the country raising funds for this case against this guy named Odell Waller, who's a black Virginia sharecropper, who killed his landlord, Oscar Davis, in self-defense. And Murray tries to prove this, and she starts working with the Workers' Defense League, a social labor rights group. And she calls up Eleanor Roosevelt, writes her, says, hey, we gotta prove this is self-defense. We got to help this Waller guy out. So Eleanor Roosevelt talks to FDR. FDR and her, they're all going, hey, we got to get Waller out, you know, and they still kill him. So it's just one of those things that so often happens in black history in this country where it ends in some sort of disgraceful martyrdom. So at Howard University, she does pretty well. She graduates and she's elected to the Chief Justice of the Howard Court of Peers, which is when men get this, they immediately then get to go to fellowships in Harvard. But since she's a woman and Harvard doesn't accept women, she's rejected by this. And she says, hey, FDR, tell Harvard to let me in. Harvard won't do it, even with Eleanor and FDR saying let her in. And she writes in response, I'd gladly change my sex to meet your requirements. But since the way to such change has not been revealed to me, I have no recourse but to appeal to you to change your minds. Are you to tell me that one is as difficult as the other? She does postgraduate work at the University of California, Berkeley, and her thesis degree was entitled The Right to Equal Opportunity in Employment, which argued the right to work is an inalienable right. She passed the California bar exam, and then she starts to get into the civil rights movement. She's very much about this Jane Crow, not just Jim Crow, saying that she has a speech called Jim Crow and Jane Crow. It's delivered in Washington, D.C. in 1964, and it sheds light on the long struggle of the African-American woman for racial equality and their later fight for equality among the sexes. As she put it, not only have they stood with the Negro man in every phase of the battle, but they have also continued to stand with their men were destroyed by it. So she eventually, President Kennedy appoints her to the Presidential Committee on the Status of Women, and she prepares a memo called the Proposal to Reexamine the 14th Amendment based on sex. In 1963, she became one of the first to criticize the sexism of the civil rights movement in her speech, The Negro Woman and the Quest for Equality. Again, I've been increasingly perturbed over the blatant disparity between the major role which Negro women have played and are playing in the crucial grassroots level of our struggle and the minor role of leadership they have been assigned in the national policy-making decisions. It is indefensible to call a national march on Washington and send out a call which contains the name of not a single woman leader. So she's ready to go. She eventually goes to Ghana and serves at the Ghana Law School, does some work there. And she serves as the vice president of Benedict College from 67 to 68. Increasingly inspired by her connections with other women in the Episcopal Church, Murray, then more than 60 years old at the time, she goes to receive a Master of Divinity degree in 1976 and becomes an Episcopal priest. And was in the first generation of Episcopal women priests. That year, she celebrates her first Eucharist by invitation and preached her first sermon at the Chapel of the Cross. In 1978, she preached in her hometown of Durham, North Carolina, on Mother's Day at the Episcopal Church, where her mother and grandparents had attended in the 19th century. For the next 7 years, Murray worked in the parish in Washington, D.C., particularly focusing on the ministry to the sick. She dies of pancreatic cancer in 1985 in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, with her lifelong friend, Maida Springer. In 2012, the General Convention of the Episcopal Church voted to honor Murray as one of its holy women, holy men, on the anniversary of her death. The National Trust of Historic Preservation designated the childhood home of Murray a national treasure, and Yale University announced that it had selected Murray as a namesake of one of its two residential colleges, Pauli Murray College. The other was named Benjamin Franklin College. In December 2016, the Pauli Murray family home was a designated historical landmark. In 2018, Murray was chosen by the National Women's History Project as one of its honorees for Women's History Month in the United States. In January 2021, a biographical documentary entitled My Name is Pauli Murray debuted the 2021 Sundance Film Festival, and that is available on Amazon. I watched it the other day. It's a very good watch. It's very, very moving. So, you'll be into it. There's also this stuff where she never really did pronouns. People don't think that she would use pronouns now. She certainly, you know, people say that she would be transgender now if she could be. But how do we know? You know what I mean? We certainly don't. When we come back, we're going to do some Pauli Murray poetry. I just thought she was a really interesting lady. You know what I mean? So raise your little Pepsi to her if you got it, if you're drinking real Pepsi. The real sugar one's out. That's nice every now and then. Just have a little bit of Pepsi. You know what I mean? Just a little bit. It's okay. It's okay. You can have a little bit of Pepsi. Drink it up. To Pauli Murray.
I am Grimes.
No.
I am Grimes. Feed
no,
me
Grimes.
Salami.
Have Pepsi. You have a little bit of Pepsi. Is the grime bits good? Write to the What Are Poems podcast at gmail.com and tell me if you want more robot grimes or less, or say, Jake, never do that again. What's happening with this podcast? Why is grimes becoming a part of it? We come back, Pauli Murray poetry. Hold on to your butts. How about we just talk about her poetry real quick before we get into it? In addition to her legal work, Murray wrote two volumes of an autobiography and a collection of poetry. Murray published a collection of her poetry, Dark Testament, and other poems in 1970. The title poem, whew, maybe I had too much Pepsi. See how quick I'm being? Gotta slow down. Talk real slow and nice. The title poem, Dark Testament, originally appeared in the winter of 1944-45 issue of Lillian Smith and Paul Snelling's South Today. Okay, so let's do a few Pauli Murray poems. It's great. It's great that all these people, a lot of these people that we discover through this thing, they sort of have this poetry connection. They might not be full-time poets, but it seems like a lot of great people always are writing a poem. So let's do To the Oppressors, right? Now you are strong. And we are but grapes aching with ripeness. Crush us. Squeeze from us all the brave life contained in these fool skins. But ours is a subtle strength, potent with centuries of yearning. of being kegged and shut away in dark, forgotten places. We shall endure to steal your senses in that lonely twilight of your winter's grief. I like how she's sort of badass, you know what I mean? Here's Mr. Roosevelt Regrets, Detroit Riot, 1943. So upon reading this account, I'll give you, Roosevelt had a statement. I'll give you that after I read it. What did you get, black boy, when they knocked you down in the gutter and they kicked your teeth out and they broke your skull with clubs and they bashed your stomach in? What'd you get when the police shot you in the back and they chained you to the beds while they wiped the blood off? What'd you get when you cried out to the top man? When you called on the man next to God, so you thought, and asked him to speak out to save you? What'd the top man say, black boy? Mr. Roosevelt Regrets. So Roosevelt responds, I share your feelings that the recent outbreaks of violence in the widely spread parts of this country endanger our national unity and comfort our enemies. I am sure that every true American regrets this. Here's Harlem Riot, 1943. Not by hammering the furious word, nor bread stamped in the streets, nor milk emptied in the gutter, shall we gain the gates of the city. But I am a prophet without eyes to see. I do not know how we shall gain the gates of the city. One more by Pauli Murray. Words, it's called. Words by Pauli Murray. We are spendthrifts with words. We squander them. Toss them like pennies in the air. Arrogant words, angry words, cruel words, comradely words, shy words tiptoeing from mouth to ear. But the slowly wrought words of love and the thunderous words of heartbreak, those we hoard. That's from Dark Testament, Other Poems by Pauli Murray, 1970. So, you could do a lot in this world. Pauli Murray did. And she had time to be a poet and bless us with a couple of good poems there. So, hey, when I come back, do you want to hear a poem by me? Maybe someone sent a poem in. Let's check the old poetry mailbag. Okay. See you soon. Here's one for Vladimir Putin, who has snail eyes. Don't his eyes look like two snails? I don't like that guy at all. And I wrote a poem about how I don't like him. So here it is. It's called Hey Putin by me. Hey Putin, what the hell, man? I'm eating my sandwich over here, having a bag of chips, and you're saying what now? You're going to drop a nuke? And who? For what? Don't you know that most of us are spending our time just sitting down after a long day and nothing, trying to get in a few minutes of Netflix to feel okay, to reach out and love the ones we love because our world is small and our world is helpless and we're fed up and we're frightened? And just a couple of years ago, we couldn't wipe our asses or feed our cats the proper food because there were shortages of this and that. And I was thinking, boy, I hope they don't run out of Aleve because that's my favorite painkiller, along with all the other painkillers like streaming and booze and cigarettes and thoughts and dinosaur fruit packs that come in packs of 30. Come on, Putin. Give me a goddamn break. That's my poem. Hey, Putin. I didn't want to talk too much about Putin because he brings me down. And let's face it, poetry, you know, these 20-minute poetry podcasts might be brightening your day up. And Putin's a little black cloud. I'm just a little black rain cloud hovering over the honey tree. That's my Winnie the Pooh impression. I'll leave you on that. Until next time, folks. Peace and love. Peace and love. Beef Jackie. Come on, shut up. What the hell? We'll be right back.